Michael Swear is a book. Art. Media. Life and Swear is about. Art.
Life and Swear is and about. Culture. Art.
Life and Swear is about. Art. Media. And culture.
Stand by. Quiet in the studio, please. Cue Norman B. Roll intro. Cue theme music. 3, 2, 1.
This is Life Elsewhere, created and hosted by Norman B.
Hello there, welcome to Life Elsewhere. I'm Norman B, and this is your weekly show about arts, media, and culture. In today's program, we welcome back Lucia Graves, writer for The Guardian. She's written two articles recently about sexual harassment, focusing on Mr. Trump and Harvey Weinstein. And my big question to Lucia is, with so many women and men that are willing to go public with their accusations and stories, is this the result of living in the age of Trump? Plus, you're going to hear me reveal for the very first time anywhere my experience with inappropriate sexual behavior. Our musical interlude this week is from Stella Donnelly out of Perth, Australia. I'm not going to say too much about it other than to say it's called Boys Will Be Boys, and I don't want you to miss it. First, let's talk about art. Art fairs, in fact. I went to Art Basel in Miami a few years ago. It was a peculiar experience. It was overwhelming, confusing, and yeah, it was intriguing all at the same time. But there's another art fair you need to know about. In fact, it's called the Other Art Fair. And here to talk about it is Ryan Stanier, the founder and director of the Other Art Fair. Ryan, welcome to Life Elsewhere.
Thank you. Yeah, nice to be on.
So the Other Art Fair is this sort of in opposition to all the other big art fairs that are around?
Yeah, I guess it is, in a way. I think my experience, well, when you say about going to Art Basel or Basel and sort of feeling overwhelmed, I think it's quite a common sort of feeling to have when you go to sort of these big major art fairs.
Yeah.
Equally for, you know, that can extend a little bit further when often you go into a gallery, you know, unless you're like an art connoisseur, you're a collector or anything, it can often be quite a scary experience. So I guess the Other Art Fair sort of is there in order to counter all of that. And why we call it the Other Art Fair is, and the main difference is that rather than the big galleries taking the booths and sort of inviting you on and selling you artwork, it's actually the artists themselves.
Uh-huh.
That actually do the booths. So you actually get to meet and buy directly from the artist and hear the stories behind the artwork. So it's a far sort of more personal sort of touch, and a lot more approachable, I think.
So it's not just not agents and galleryists showing the work, it's the artists themselves. I want to get into this deeper, and I want to talk about the whole organisation of the Other Art Fair. But before we get to that, let's just very quickly talk about art itself, because I do believe that there is some misconceptions about what art is and what art isn't. Can you, just from your point of view as the founder and director of the Other Art Fair, maybe you can sort of give us a little overview of what we're talking about when we're talking about art these days?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there's, one sort of definition that everyone could sort of express what art is. I guess for me and, sort of my association with the fair and the way that I sort of interact with art, I guess it's, well, from an artist's perspective, a lot of the time it's around, sort of, obviously it's through expression. But I think it's also interesting to think about how it comes from people wanting, so, I mean, if in the context of an art fair, so from a buyer's perspective, it's interesting to see their sort of motives behind buying an artwork, whether it be an emotional connection to a work or whether, they're simply wanting to live in a space or a house where there's sort of attractive things on the wall. I think, probably with the Other Art Fair, the nice thing is that you it's all about the close connection and the emotional connection that you would have with artwork.
Yes.
Just really sort of bring something positive into your life, I guess.
What do you think are the major misconceptions that people have about not just art, but about art fairs?
I think probably that, it's that old traditional sort of feeling that it's unapproachable. And it's even now, I would go around, I mean, you know, I've been to hundreds of art fairs all over the world, and I still have that feeling of, like, you know, you feel a bit anxious sort of walking in, and you don't know where to look, you don't know who you're actually allowed to, you know, who you're allowed to talk to. Are they looking at my shoes? Are they checking out what watch I'm wearing and that sort of thing?
Yes.
And I guess my approach is, I want to break all of that down and say, look, you don't have to be that person to actually enjoy an art fair and actually come in and, you know, have a good experience.
Yes. You know, you've just summed it up very well, because I remember going to Miami and it seemed to me that everybody was looking at everybody else, seeing what they were wearing and who was who, yeah, and who knew who. And there was a lot of sort of glad handing going on and sort of smug sort of looks that people had. But the other art fair is different to that. So let's talk about the other art fair. So it's been happening in a number of different locations right now, as we speak right now in Brooklyn. We're not in Brooklyn, of course, but this show goes out all over the place, so people in Brooklyn can go and check it out. So talk about what the other art fair, where it's at, what it's doing, and just give us a little sort of documentary of what's happening. Yeah.
So just a brief history is that I launched the fair 7 years ago in London, and the whole idea was to twofold: give an opportunity for unrepresented artists to actually showcase and sell their work, but then on the flip side, actually give an audience, or, you know, the sort of general public, a place to actually go interact in a sort of safe, fun environment, and actually to buy art, and, you know, give them the confidence to actually buy artwork.
Mm-hmm.
So it started in London. We run it twice a year in London now, and also in Bristol. We then extended out to Australia because we saw that there was, you know, sort of a thriving artist community out in Sydney specifically.
Yeah.
And that's worked very well. We extended to Melbourne. And now we're in Brooklyn this weekend, and it's actually happening at the Brooklyn Expo Centre, which is in Greenpoint. And it's happening all weekend.
The art that you're showing, how do you decide? Who decides? What's the sort of the qualifications to get your work exhibited at the other art fair?
Well, the idea is that any artist from anywhere in the world can apply for any fair. Typically, we have about 1,000 applications for each fair.
Yeah.
We then have a selection committee that would go through, choose the best 100 artists, and then it'd be those artists that would be present at the fair.
Mm-hmm.
And this year, for this Brooklyn Expo Fair, it's actually headed up by the chief curator of Saatchi Art. Her name's Rebecca Wilson.
Uh-huh.
Sort of oversees the whole selection. That's generally how it works.
So the art itself, Ryan, things over the years, I mean, what we know as art, we talked about this right at the very beginning, what we consider to be art and what, and everybody's got a sort of a different sort of view on this. Art that you're showing at the other art fair, would you say that it falls into certain categories? Can you sort of lump things together?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of, like, medium, I mean, it's everything from, this is, I guess I would say, you know, broadly speaking, across any art fair, the nice thing about going to, you know, an art fair is that you get to see paintings, you get to see photography, collage, digital art, sculpture.
Mm-hmm.
So really, depending whatever your sort of level of interest is, then, I mean, it's all sort of in one room, I guess. And that's the benefit of sort of going, trudging around lots of different galleries. It's sort of all in one place.
I want to talk to you about the position of artists and the position of buyers. And we're going to do that after a quick break, right after this.
Okay.
You are listening to Life Elsewhere with Norman B. You can learn more about this program at lifeelsewhere.co. That's C-O.
My guest, if you're just joining us, is Ryan Stanier. He's the founder and director of the Other Art Fair. It's going on in Brooklyn this weekend, but it's also happening in other locations around the world. And even if you can't get to it, we'll have a link up on our website so you can look and see what's happening. And if people go to the website, to your website, to the Other Art Fair, there's ways that they can find out about the arts, and if they wanted to buy something, they can do it there in that direction. Or there's lots of connections through going to your site, yeah?
Yeah, there is. I mean, depending on what fair you want to attend,
right,
sort of select the right fair and then come along if it's on over that weekend.
Yes.
In addition to that, actually, I would say that sort of my interest at the beginning when I started was creating an opportunity for artists that didn't have an exclusive representation with a gallery. And I guess running art fairs doesn't always give you the chance to sort of do that over the whole year. So you have the 4 days at the fair, but also we now work with Saatchi Art.
Yeah.
So even if you can't make it along to the fair over the weekend, you can still see the artists that participated, check out their profiles on Saatchi Art, and even buy a work from them.
I love it. It's a great idea. I didn't say a collector. That sounds so pompous saying that. But over the years, I've bought art. I mean, you know, I guess being an art school person myself, it's in my blood, I guess. So let's talk about artists for a moment. It is difficult making a living being an artist, and very few people actually do hit the big time.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of great people. There's a lot of great work being produced out there. So from your point of view as the founder and director of the Other Art Fair, what advice do you give to artists that want to show their work? What are some of the things that they need to know before they put their work on display?
Yeah, I mean, I get often asked this question, actually. And first of all, I'd like to say that probably now there's more opportunities as an artist to actually make a living and sustain a living. Just because, you know, when you're suggesting, oh, well, you know, how you might not be sort of, you might not end up being one of the big blue chip named artists that everyone knows, household names. That's not to say that you couldn't be, you know, a practicing professional artist that, you know, earns enough money to go and buy the house. But it just might not mean that you might ever be famous
in
that way.
Yes, yes, yes.
For example, there's lots of artists now that, you know, sustain their practice through selling their work, even through like Instagram or other social medias. So technology sort of really sort of opened up the opportunities for artists. Equally, there's so many brands now that are looking to do collaborations with artists.
Right, yes.
So it's not just, I mean, you know, even looking maybe only 10 years ago, the likelihood is if you're an artist, you're a painter, you're creating your paintings and you're trying to get them into a gallery to sell them on your behalf. And that's your only source of income. Now there's so many ways that you can actually sustain yourself. I think probably art schools need to do a little bit more in order to sort of catch up with this. And they probably need to be offering more business advice to artists, because I think when you sort of leave art school, as I'm sure you've experienced, you feel like you're into the big wide world, you know how to create artwork, but you think, well, how do I, you know, make a living
out of it. Yes, I think that's the big, big question. So let's talk about that from the Other Art Fair point of view. So how does it work? So you do this selection, you've got the artists that you've now decided, okay, these ones are going to be in the Other Art Fair. So how do you just divvy up? What I mean, they put a price on it, or you put a price on it? How does that work? How does the pricing work for artwork?
Well, I mean, all the artists that we work with, they will have prices for their artwork already. I mean, we're working with artists. They're not really just straight out of school looking to sell their first artworks. I mean, all the artists that we work with, they will have worked with galleries on some level. So there will be sort of an existing consistent price.
Yeah.
And then we work with them to sort of, well, we create the booths for them. And then it's up to the artist to come in and curate their work. And I mean, we work closely with them, but
right,
it's really up to them to do it themselves.
So they've got to do, they've got to put their effort in. Let me ask you this, Ryan, about art around the world, because you're doing the Other Art Fair in different locations, in Sydney, as you said, in Bristol, which is a lovely place in England, in London, in Brooklyn. How does it change around the world? Are you seeing sort of certain things happening in one place and not in others?
I think it's from a buying perspective, yes. And I always like to think, I mean, I think in London, maybe in New York, the audience, like collectors or buyers that are walking around the fair buying, they're quite discerning. They're very thoughtful in the process of buying an artwork. What I love about doing it in Australia is that I feel like, and I think also in London and New York, people are always a little bit more concerned about, you know, what is somebody going to think about this artwork? What does this artwork say about me if I'm buying it?
Yes, yes.
What I love about doing the fair in Australia is that there's such a confidence behind buying really alternative work, just because they want to buy it, connects with them. And I think that sort of side of things doesn't really come into play so much.
That's such an interesting thing. That's such a good observation. I like that because there's one thing that I sort of really makes me sort of cringe is when you hear somebody say, "Oh, that'd go good with the sofa." So who's buying art these days, Ryan? Who goes to the other art fair and purchases artwork?
Well, everyone really. I mean, everyone from, you know, we have interns or, you know, volunteers that sort of students working at the fair. And I guess this is where the other art fair is so unique, is that there's something for them.
Yes.
You know, they can come and spend $50 on a print and be very happy with that, all the way through to, you know, there'll be some collectors in New York this weekend that hear about the fair and they might have bought, you know, $1 million artworks, but they'll be interested to come along and see what, you know, fresh new talent there is on show this weekend. So, and it really is everyone in between.
Yes. Directions, where do you see, because there's so many these days, as you said earlier on, there's so many different facets, there's so many different media to work in. But is there a direction? Are there things going in one way or another? Or what would you recommend for buyers?
Oh, I mean, the only thing really that you can recommend is to buy what you like.
Yeah.
I mean, really, it's as simple as that. I mean, often people will say, oh, you know, what are the trends that you can see happening? Or, you know, do you recommend buying any particular type of artwork from any particular artist? Ultimately, it comes down to you have to live with the work. And if it connects with you and you enjoy looking at it, I mean, really, that's the only thing that matters.
Now, are people still buying art that come to the other art fair, looking at art for investment point of view?
Yeah, I think they are. I think they are. And I think, again, that's kind of our unique positioning because these are artists in the sort of earlier stages of their career. So they haven't been snapped up by a big gallery at this particular point. And we've had artists in the past. I mean, one sort of artist pops into mind in London. We were showing his work 2 years ago for, I think he was selling his paintings for about £1,000. He then gets signed up by a gallery. This year he actually did a sellout show. And the minimum price of his artworks are $25,000.
Goodness.
So, I mean, it's quite a significant jump in price. And if you think if you came to the fair and bought it for $1,000, I mean, you'd be pretty happy today.
Now, I'm curious about this. We're talking to Ryan Stanier. He's the founder and director of the Other Art Fair. The link will be up at the Life Elsewhere site so you can check out what we're really talking about here. I'm wondering, Ryan, in some of the artwork that you have at the other art fair, whether it's London, whether it's Brooklyn, Sydney, is there ever a time, this is an awkward question really, is there ever a time you've got things in there and you go, oh, this is so good, this is so good, but it just doesn't sell and no, everybody ignores it? I mean, it's just one of those, it's just a flop. Have you had that happen?
Yes, all the time. And it's really interesting because the team, we know intimately all the artists, the artwork that's coming in, and we'll always have, you know, we'll always pick out two or three.
Yeah.
And you think, you know, I think I've run 25 art fairs now.
Right.
So, you know, I should have a good understanding of what's going to sell and what's not. Every time I'm surprised.
Yes.
And it's almost, you can rest assured, the artists that you pick out as the best ones, I mean, they're not going to be the best sellers always. So.
Yes. Something we're going to be talking about later in the program today is dealing with, and this is very thin connection, but let me go for it anyway. We're going to be talking about sexual harassment because this is huge in the news right now, and we're going to get into it in great detail. But having said that, just as a sort of a segue, are we seeing a proportion now more? Is it divided? Is it, just give me an overview of the sort of the split between men and women, or does it make a difference? Do you care? Just give me sort of a feeling about that.
So from an artist's perspective, there's actually quite an interesting some research that was done last year, and it was looking into the big major galleries and also the sort of museums, and looking at the museum shows and seeing what percentage of shows are for, you know, they put on for male artists and what were for female.
Yeah.
And I think it was about 85% were actually for male artists. Also in the big galleries, when they're looking at the sort of top selling female artists compared to the top selling male artists, again, there's such a divide in terms of, you know, the value, the perceived value of artwork for the male artists. So that's definitely something that needs to be addressed.
Yes.
From our perspective, I guess we're more grassroots and representative of, you know, artists coming through at an earlier stage. and we actually did research based on this. 51% of our artists at this coming fair are actually female. So, I mean, it's pretty good.
Yes.
It's not saying that there are more male artists out there or more female artists. I mean, we've shown that it really is quite a clean split between the two. As an industry, I mean, at least, I'd say from my experience, there's probably more females or women working in the arts than men.
Yes.
But unfortunately, it's still a male-dominated industry.
Yes.
I mean, you know, if you're looking at all the top gallerists in the world, I mean, you know, they're overwhelmingly going to be men.
Yes. Just to finalise here, just to finish up, when you've got all this artwork in the exhibition, in the other art fair, is there ever a time that there's something there, you've got some artwork and you just, it's been selected, and I'm taking my time getting to this because it's sort of an awkward question, but is there a time when you've got some artwork there and it sells and the artist is doing well, but you go, oh my God, it's just awful, it's just horrible? Does that ever happen?
Well,
you don't. I'm sorry, I'm putting you on the spot.
No, but the honest answer is say yes, but that would only be my own personal opinion.
Yeah.
Fact is that all the artists at the fair would have been chosen by a selection committee member anyway.
Right.
So the quality's there, but that would just simply be my personal
Your personal taste.
Like the work.
Right. And that's really, Well, that's where we sort of started on, isn't it? What art is, and it's the personal taste. So that's a good place where we can sort of wrap this up.
Yeah.
It's called The Other Art Fair. We've been talking to Ryan Stanier. He's the founder and director. The link will be up at the Life Elsewhere site. Ryan, it's been a delight talking to you. We wish you all the very best. You know, I would really like to get you on the show again and talk about the difference, or the the percentage of men and women in art and in the art world, because I think it's a fascinating conversation.
Yeah, I agree. No, I'd love to.
Yeah. Well, thank you so very much indeed. I do appreciate it, and good luck with the other art fair. Right.
Thank you very much. Thanks, Norman.
Still to come in the show, an intense conversation with Guardian writer Lucia Graves on why so many women and men are now willing to go public with their accusations and stories of sexual harassment. The question, is this the result of living in the age of Trump? But first, a musical interlude. Listen carefully. This one may make some people uncomfortable. From Perth, Australia, it's Stella Donnelly with Boys Will Be Boys.
do hope you listen to that one carefully. Boys Will Be Boys by Stella Donnelly. If you want to hear this show again, it's available over at MPR1 and on iTunes. The links are up at lifeelsewhere.co. Next, a serious and emotive conversation with talented writer Lucia Graves about sexual harassment. Right after this.
You are listening to Life Elsewhere with Norman B.
The headline, Donald Trump's sexual harassment accusers hope president goes way of Weinstein. That's headline number one. Headline number two, hashtag MeToo Congress. Women in politics take action in wake of Weinstein. Two headlines from one of our favorite writers for The Guardian, Lucia Graves. Lucia, thank you so much for joining us at Life Elsewhere once again.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Okay. So I've got to take a big, deep sigh. I'm this whole thing with Weinstein, with Trump, with Kevin Spacey. I mean, the list goes on and goes on and goes on. It's just it's nonstop now. The Roy Moore thing. I don't know where to begin. Yet I do know where to begin, and that is something has happened where we're now talking about the subjects that hasn't really been ever talked about the way it's been addressed now. There was once upon a time a gentleman that was being nominated for the Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember that so distinctly. Anita Hill's testimony was riveting. Yet it was almost made fun of. So let's just go back in time, if you wouldn't mind. Talk about sexual harassment and the way we've treated women and the way men have just been misogynist. It's just been part of the culture. It's been part of what has gone on, not just in this country, but around the world. Is it human nature? I don't know. Let's get into it.
I'm really glad that you mentioned the Anita Hill hearings, because it does feel right now like we're sort of in the middle of a sexual harassment revolution.
Yeah.
We've never talked about these issues the way that we're talking about them now, both in reporting and response and results. To take it back to the Anita Hill testimony from the 1990s, that was the first time that we ever really, as a society, even came into contact with the term sexual harassment. It just wasn't in our cultural lexicon.
Yes.
Until she started testifying against Clarence Thomas, who was up to be nominated for the Supreme Court. And again, in a political context, you have to make decisions about the character of these men. And very often you only have like a very limited amount of time. You're not going to have a trial. You're not going to have a jury. You're just going to have women like Anita Hill saying what happened to them.
And one of the things that I think that came out of the Anita Hill, or I guess the Clarence Thomas hearings, was victim shaming. And that sort of phrase has come up a lot in the recent days. The Roy Moore thing, I see GOP's people defending or suggesting that the young lady, well, she was 14-year-old, the child, she used poor judgment, the comparisons to Mary and Joseph. They say Mary was a teenager, so what's the big deal? It's just bizarre. It's just truly, truly bizarre. But let's once again go back just a little bit, Lucia, because for so long, talking about sexual innuendo and jokes and just the way that we've treated women in our day-to-day life. I'm sort of stumbling over my words here because I feel kind of annoyed so much because my fellow males have just been so righteous about this, and now women are speaking out. Let's get your take.
Well, I think there's so much to unpack here. That's why this sort of sexual harassment revolution, I'm calling it, has had to take place over decades. Anita Hill, Clarence Thomas still got nominated for the Supreme Court and successfully landed there, but that helped us establish the language that we need to even talk about these problems in the first place. Trump had a number of accusers, I think 24 accusers, come out, 20 of them by name on the record, but was still elected president. And then now, this year, we saw with the Harvey Weinstein allegations that people are not giving men the benefit of the doubt anymore. And, you know, there's been no lawsuit, no jury, no definitive outcome in a legal sense, but we're already sort of seeing consequences for these stories. And so I think we're seeing a real evolution in how we talk about these questions, and also how we listen to them as a society, and that we do listen.
Let's just focus just for a moment, once again, on something which a guest I had on the program just a couple of weeks ago, a professor of anthropology, Augustin Fuentes, and he said, and this is a quote, he said, "If men are not naturally sexual predators, why does it happen so often?" But let me ask you, from a woman's point of view, does it seem that men are sexual predators?
Well, I think we have to be really careful with the language there. He said naturally, and I'm going to take issue with that.
Yeah.
I do think that this is not just a few bad apples. I think these stories are going to keep coming out. It's Harvey Weinstein was just the breaking of the dam. Kevin Spacey, Louis C.K., Roy Moore, these names are going to keep coming forward. There are going to be more and more of these allegations, because this is a part of a culture that doesn't just allow for the harassment of women, but it actually helps men thrive in sort of treating women this way. I do think it's not a coincidence that you have so many men in power who act this way. It's what we teach our kids about what it means to be powerful and what it means to be a man, that like ownership and manipulation of women's sexuality is a way to form a male identity. And I don't think that that's natural, but I do think that it's sort of endemic to our society. And in that sense, Trump is more of a symptom of our culture than the actual disease.
Yes, yes. When we're talking about sexual harassment and we're talking about abusing women, there's all these different sort of, one thing sort of crosses a line to another thing. And then we get into this whole area of abuse and physical abuse, and there's different sort of strains that we can go down. Do you think there's a danger in that this is all coming to light now and we're getting very confused, where lots of pundits are talking about, you know, Louis C.K., about Roy Moore, about Trump, and that we get sort of misled with lots of quotes, lots of great sound bites, but we're not really discussing what the real issue is? And I want to talk about what the real issue is right after this.
We'd love to hear what you have to say. Write to this address, info@lifeelsewhere.co. That's C-O.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Lucia Graves. She's written two interesting articles in The Guardian, which she writes for, about sexual harassment. Is talking about women in politics take action in the wake of Weinstein, and all the different stories that have come out. My question to you is, what is the real issue here? Where are we going with this? Because story after story is coming to light. Names, the list of names is, I'm just looking down the list right now, and this is just a few: Roy Moore, Louis C.K., Kevin Spacey, Jeremy Piven, Mark Halperin, Dustin Hoffman, the list goes on and on. Of course, Mr. Trump. What is the real issue here, Lucia?
I think where we're going is moving closer to making what has always been sort of the collective reality of less powerful groups, and not just women, not just exclusively women, but particularly women. Those stories are coming to light. But this has always been the reality for a lot of us. It's just becoming more public now. That's what it gets sort of labeled as gossip, and sort of things that belong in the tabloids, or that, you know, serious people need not concern themselves with. But actually, it's always been there. It's just never been sort of sanctioned. It's never been reported as a serious political story in the way that it is now.
It does seem that there is a feeling that people can speak out, well, women can speak out now safely and talk about how they feel. And again, as a man, I'm wondering whether women have, and I always hear this, I hear about women saying that they were afraid to speak out because it could, because there's this embarrassment thing, and as we talked about earlier, about being shamed, about the victim shaming. So I'm wondering whether the climate now does feel safer, does feel like it's safety in numbers. Could that be it?
I think there's an element of safety in numbers, but I also think that there maybe even in a more pronounced way is an element of anger in numbers. A lot of these women thought that they were more alone than they actually are. Mm. And when you hear other people telling stories, and sometimes you'll hear people write about this or speak about this, that they thought that they were the only victim. Yeah. But in fact, they were one of dozens. So there's a sense in which they thought that they were just sort of sparing someone trouble by not speaking out. But you realize in retrospect that actually you're enabling someone.
I was wondering when I was just doing some research for talking to you about this topic. Sadly, she's gone. Joan Rivers, the great comedian, Joan Rivers is no longer with us. But in her acts, she would be sexually explicit. She would talk about things that you would never hear other women talk about. And I'm wondering what Joan Rivers, I mean, I'm just supposing, what she would make of these revelations, these people being outed now. And as I'm thinking about that, I'm thinking about comedians. I'm thinking about Sarah Silverman, who is definitely around, and she's a truly an outspoken comedian who deals with taboo topics in her act. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking about whether we're going to hear more from comedians, from people that are in that position, like a Sarah Silverman, like if she was around, like a Joan Rivers. And really, what would they say? What would be their take on this?
Well, I think that we will be hearing a lot more, I think, especially from comedians and Hollywood and the artistic community. And I don't think it's a coincidence that we've seen so much traction for these stories in Hollywood and a kind of momentum that we haven't really seen politically. Stories came out about Trump, but they didn't ultimately affect the election. And even now, with the new allegations out about Roy Moore molesting underage women, it's not clear that he won't be elected next month anyway. Yes. Yes. It's not at all clear. Whereas in Hollywood, we are sort of seeing people talk about and condemn this behavior. Harvey Weinstein has already sort of lost everything professionally in terms of the career that he built. Kevin Spacey has had his show pulled. He'll no longer be in House of Cards, and Louis C.K. didn't make an appearance last night. We're already seeing consequences for men in Hollywood.
Yes.
And so I do think that that is sort of the culture that's going to help us talk about these issues. It's more open in a way. The whole sort of sexual harassment revolution is coming much more slowly to Washington and to politics. People are much more cagey here in D.C., where I am.
Alongside the sexual harassment issue, there is this other, I think it's a parallel thing here, and that is the inequality of, for instance, what men earn in the workplace and the positions that men hold and equal to women. Earlier on in the program, I spoke with a gentleman who's the founder and director of the Other Art Fair, which is taking place in Brooklyn this weekend, and I asked him the question about the percentage of women and men in the arts. And he said, oh, yeah, yeah. And he said this reluctantly, that it's the art world is dominated by men. So, again, I'm just sort of going to throw this out to you, Lucia, is here we are talking about sexual harassment, but there is this parallel thing about the equality. And it's sort of like, it seems to me that it's interwoven.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, these part and parcel of the same thing. It's, if you are in an environment as a woman where the powers that be sort of discourage you or make it harder for you to sort of rise up, that's going to have an effect in sort of what roles you can take, what you'll be paid. The people at the top of industry, and this is true in really every competitive industry, are men. And if we allow these sort of abusive dynamics to take place, it also entrenches power at the top, and it makes it harder for women to sort of progress or stay in careers or stay in offices at all. There's a lot of women freelancers, and I don't think that that's a coincidence.
I want to now go off on a somewhat of a tangent, and bear with me with this one. And this is when Mr. Spacey's story, it was brought to light, and a lot of people in the entertainment industry were very aware of Kevin Spacey's his predilection for men. It was no secret, and like it's no secret about a lot of people in the entertainment business. The idea of men molesting men is now that becomes a sort of a somewhat of an even a taboo. It's like a double taboo for talking about, but it has come out, and I'm wondering if we can talk about that in the same way that we can talk about harassment of women. What are your thoughts on that?
One thing that is true in the Spacey story, and I think a number of these stories, is we're talking not just about vulnerable men, but about boys, underage people who don't know what their rights are, probably don't necessarily know the extent to which they're being abused and what their options are for coming forward. So we often hear these stories very belatedly, if we hear them at all. And I also think that it's additionally complicated for a lot of men by issues of sexuality. I think that those stories are even rarer and even harder to get in some ways because they're so burdened by age and by sexuality and by all of these things that make them even more vulnerable.
Well, one of the reasons that I focused in on that is, and this is going to be somewhat difficult for me to talk about, and I'm not so sure that I'm going to go full details with this, but I'm just going to say it anyway. But I had an experience when I was 14 years old where a man exposed himself at me in a public restroom, and I was mortified. I was absolutely did not understand what was happening. I was, but I didn't tell anyone. I didn't tell my parents. I didn't tell anyone. I think this is the first time I've actually spoken about it. But
wow!
It I don't say it traumatized me, but it really bothered me a great deal. And I think I sort of kept it under wraps because I was fearful that somebody would think that I had done something. And I'm positive that lots of other people must go through this same situation. But what worries me about this, and the reason I'm bringing this up, is that here I was going to the bathroom in a public restroom in the lovely seaside town of Brighton in the coast of England. And here's a man that felt very comfortable, I guess, in doing a lewd act in front of me. And it just, from a father's point of view, because I have a teenage son, it just makes me think, how in the world did this man think that was perfectly okay to do? What was going through his mind? And again, I'm now thinking back to Roy Moore. I'm thinking about Mr. Trump. I'm thinking about any of these people. Where does that come from? What happens?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's fairly common to feel implicated in acts that you actually have no reason to feel implicated in at all, and that makes it even harder to talk about them. So I'm glad that you're talking about it now, because a lot of people never get there. In some of a story that came out just yesterday about one of the top literary editor at the New Republic, who a lot of was sort of a serial harasser and abuser for decades there, I think. The last woman to speak out about him said she had just never, not only had she never told her story, but she actually apologized to him later for telling another editor about it. She said she brought it to the sort of editorial attention, not out of any hope that, you know, he would be fired or retribution, but just because she wanted someone to, because it bothered her. She felt uncomfortable and she just wanted to know that someone cared. And she felt so bad about doing even this small act that she apologized to the man that assaulted her.
Yes. Wow, this is such a, there's such a lot to talk about here. It really, we're talking to Lucia Graves. She's a writer for The Guardian. She's written two pieces. She's written a number of pieces on the subject of sexual harassment. And we're sort of focusing in on, is this sort of story about sexual harassment, is this whole subject coming to light now because of Weinstein or maybe because of Trump? And I want to focus in on Mr. Trump, and I'll explain right after this.
You're listening to the best show on radio about art, media, and culture. Life Elsewhere with Norman B. Diamond in the back, sunroof top, digging the scene
with the gasoline. My guest is Lucia Graves. She writes for The Guardian. She's written a couple of articles about sexual harassment. And my question has been focusing in on, in the age of Trump, with the stories about Trump, where there's lots of allegations, he denies them, etc. Breaking news. I just saw this before we started talking, Lucia. NBC News reports longtime Trump bodyguard Keith Schiller told Congress that before the Miss Universe pageant in 2013, a Russian participant offered to send five women to Trump's hotel room in Moscow. And Paul Wood, chief BBC Russia correspondent, has written of multiple witnesses at the Ritz in Moscow who saw women with Trump as he tried to get them up to his room without having to sign them in. Now, the reason I'm mentioning this is because all these stories have circulated around Trump, and particularly this dossier that this British spy has been flouting around all over the place. And I'm wondering, If this whole sort of grotesque story, and we don't have to go into the horrible details, but it now does seem like there's some substance of this whole story. Will this change things because now we are actually talking about the president? How do we, as a public, as a society, as voters, do we take this with us to the voting booth?
Well, I think that a lot of the sort of details of these allegations against Trump are becoming clear sort of only in retrospect. I don't think there was enough early interest during the campaign in reporting these kinds of stories. I think journalism is actually in some ways very ill-equipped to talk about harassment and assault stories, that we have sort of a, journalists have sort of an adversarial style of interviewing frequently, especially sort of print investigative reporters, the people who would be tasked with doing this. And that's very often the last way you want to approach victims of trauma. So we're kind of figuring out how to do these stories, I think in some ways for the first time ever, really. And for Trump, that's very much a, in retrospect, kind of realization. We didn't even have most accusers step forward until October, before the election. So there really wasn't time to sort of unpack the allegations against him, which range from, his first wife alleged rape, and to the more sort of just forcible kissing and sort of grabbing of women, which he has admitted to on tape.
Yes, and you go in one of your articles, you interviewed some of the people that have made accusations about Trump.
Yeah, I went back and talked to a number of his accusers just last week. Most people consider Harvey Weinstein to be the story that sort of broke the dam on this, but you can't follow the assault stories that are coming out now and the harassment stories that are coming out now without remembering that there is literally a person who admitted to sexual assault on tape in the White House, and we had two dozen women tell us about it before we voted him into office. So I think that for sort of American society, we knew these women were there and we elected him anyways. And sort of our response to the victim speaking up now has to be shaped in some way by just sort of the magnitude of that kind of failing. And then there are the women themselves who had sort of a range of reactions to what's going on. I think a number of women sort of felt forgotten in all of this, just sort of like, why did that, the Trump sort of story, freeze in time? You know, just because he's the president now doesn't mean that other people can't come forward, stop, but they have sort of stopped coming forward. And people have not been interviewing Trump's accusers until this sort of recent flood of stories around sexual harassment broke last month.
Mm. I want to now move just a little bit to the fact that I heard a GOP pundit made reference to, you can't be making accusations about Roy Moore when you had a president that was doing all the kind of filthy, disgusting stuff that President Clinton was doing. Can we lump Clinton in with the people that we're talking about right now? Weinstein, Trump, Roy Moore?
I don't think that it's useful to sort of look back and try to excuse people currently running for office by saying that in the past other men behaved badly too. I don't think that's a useful benchmark at all. But it was one that was brought up a lot, and particularly inappropriately during the campaign, as an attack on Hillary Clinton, despite the fact that we're talking about her husband's behavior, not her own.
Mm. Let's move on just a little bit. We're talking to Lucia Graves, writer for The Guardian. Hashtag MeTooCongress. Women in politics take action in wake of Weinstein.
So this was a reaction to the Me Too social media movement, was sparked in the wake of Harvey Weinstein allegations, and just sort of a celebrity tweeted, you know, I have a story like this. Under that hashtag, people all over the world started sharing their stories, and I think just about every woman has a story that, and not just women, of course, have stories that they can share that speak to the kind of harassment that we're hearing about in the news every single day now. And Jackie Speier in California, a lawmaker in California, started the hashtag MeTooCongress as a way of sort of talking about the problems that exist in politics specifically and in the Capitol. And she, as part of that, shared a story about coming up on Capitol Hill and being assaulted by a chief of staff in her congressional office, and then just sort of in the way that so many of us do, burying that and not telling anyone about it because she felt, again, complicit is sort of the buzzword of the times. That if, you know, he stuck his tongue down her throat, she must have been in some kind of position to make that possible.
Yeah.
And so, and she's actually the only lawmaker that I'm aware of who has shared the name of the person who she alleges assaulted her on the record. But a number of other members of Congress have stepped forward with anonymous allegations about harassment and propositions that they received inappropriately from members of Congress as well.
So I guess we can also say that is this the tip of the iceberg? Is this going to go much further than we could ever imagine?
Absolutely, yeah. I don't know when we're going to see the end of this, but there are a lot more stories that are going to come out in the coming weeks and months.
Will this change how we look at sex? How we look at the fact that sex is everywhere? As my anthropologist, that was a professor that was on the program a couple of weeks ago, he said, sex is everywhere. You can't escape it. It's part of our lives. So do we distinguish between what is sex and what is abuse? Can we do that? Are we able to do that? The line becomes, even for us, for you and I, that seem like we're intelligently trying to figure it all out, it seems to me that the way we're looking at things is going to change dramatically. Probably the way that we now look at politicians is going to change dramatically after the world of Trump.
Oh, goodness. I hope so. That is the best thing that could possibly come out of this, is that the cultural will actually finally change. But we've been talking about this since second wave feminism was about saying that the personal is political. That's exactly what this is now. We're just sort of realizing the definition of that and what it means for your everyday behavior. But we've been, the feminist movement has been working on this for decades.
Yes.
And there's backlash to progress, but that's what this is.
Yes. It's always a pleasure talking to you. Thank you so very much for joining us. Lucia Graves, she writes for The Guardian. Links will be up at the Life Elsewhere site. Lucia, thank you so very much for joining us at Life Elsewhere.
Thanks for having me. Always a pleasure.
Thank you so much for joining me for another edition of Life Elsewhere. Details about the show and all the links are up at lifeelsewhere.co. Till next time, be well, be good, and always, it costs nothing, be nice.
You have been listening to Life Elsewhere, created and hosted by Norman B. Life Elsewhere is written and produced by Norman B. Guest booking and additional research by Stephanie Lane. Behind the scenes assistance by James Van, Bruce Goodman, and Allison Klein. We love to hear what you think about Life Elsewhere. Send your questions, queries, and comments to info@lifeelsewhere.co. That's C-O. Life Elsewhere is produced at the studios of WMNF Tampa.